We're back. We'd like to thank everybody for listening to this janky little podcast. We got longtime friend. We're thankful to have him on the podcast finally. Should be a good listen. We'll go around and everybody can say who's here today.
I'm Jim Webley.
I'm Devin.
So Devin and Jim are both guides. Jim's been here forever. Yeah. You've been guiding for the past outfitter, Reggie, and then mm-hmm. you stayed on helping us, thank goodness. All right, so you want to tell some of your stories from archery season, kind of recap how you think your archery season went?
It was a great year, I thought. The elk, I mean, they were early this year, it seemed like, but they were bugling. I remember years ago, it seems like the elk started changing their patterns and some of the ways that they were living, and even in the rut, it seemed to be a little bit different, but this year seemed to be more like what I remember from the past. There's a lot of elk, and there usually is a lot of elk, but it's whether or not they're going to be bugling. But we ended up getting into a lot of elk, a lot of really nice ones this year. Like I'm saying, they're one of the bulls we were after. I think he was close to a 350 bull.
Stud.
Yeah, he was just a horse. And there were several ones, elk, not quite as big as him, but very, very nice elk. So yeah, I think it was a good year.
I had noticed the last probably 3 years that elk, we've been, if you look back over like the amount of opportunities and the amount of days that you're into elk, it just seemed like there's been a steady increase of the days that you're into elk. You're like in the ball game. You're actually chasing elk. Right. You're hearing them. You're smelling them, seeing them. And you can count on one hand how many days this year. I think that guys weren't into elk. In years past, you'd maybe go a whole few 4 days, a whole week sometime. Yeah. I went a whole week before and couldn't find elk.
Right.
Pretty neat. I don't know. What do you think is causing that?
I'm not sure what's causing it. I know the fishing game, I think it was a year ago, they started really collaring elk because they wanted to figure out what was kind of going on with them.
I like to credit a little bit of it that we got a new biologist. I think he does a pretty good job, honestly. I'm not saying our last one didn't, but we're regulating predators, I think, a lot more than what mm-hmm. we have.
Yeah.
A lot more.
I think the predator numbers are down and the elk numbers are up.
Yep.
I think it was just a lot of little things that created a great storm for us.
Yeah.
Because this archery season, I just did the math. So we finished the season out at 68% honest opportunity. But then whenever I calculated how many clients had double opportunities, it was 110%.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. With only a couple clients not having an actual opportunity.
Right.
But a lot of that had to do with the clients.
Yeah, it always does. Yeah. Depends on the weather, what the elk are doing, the rut, how the rut hits, and the clients. You know, some clients, they really don't want to get back in too far and get it. You know, everybody has their own preference and their own skill level, so that always plays into it.
In the previous podcast, we said that we would tell the story of the week with Justin and Knox.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was a great week for you.
Oh, yeah.
How many opportunities did they end up having?
Oh, man. You know, it's kind of interesting that usually I could tell you because there's only, you know, you'd have one or two honest opportunities, not just hearing them or getting close. But there was just in one day we just hit it right, and everything seemed to line up. We had several bulls that were coming in, I mean, close, and where we had honest opportunities to actually get one. I know Justin took a shot at a really nice bull and ended up hitting a limb that he didn't see, and the arrow went flying off, and Knox actually had a good opportunity at that bull. That bull was right in front of him, raking his horns, and I was back, I don't know, maybe 100, 120 yards, but I could still see the top of this great big tree just whipping back and forth. And I was thinking, man, that is so close to Knox. Knox is about ready to get this bull. And then the bull, he just backed up out of there, and his dad had already moved in. Justin was really good at being able to get himself into a position where he could get a shot. And like you said, you know, some clients are very good at certain skill sets that really help them out. That was one of Justin's skill sets, was being able to think outside the box and make things happen. And So that's what he did. He had a shot at that bull, and then right away he took out after another bull, and but that it was a herd bull, had the cows with him, and he worked down after it. But
trying to figure out if the bull was coming into Knox, how did his father get there?
Justin is like one of those guys, it's like he could have been on the other side of the mountain, he would have wrapped around and been right on it. But you know, that's Justin ended up shooting the bull, making a great shot. It was a, you know, these bulls, they don't like to come in out in the open, turn sideways for you, and you know, even turn their head away from you so that you can draw your bow back. They have a way of coming in very quiet in the brush, shoulder against, you know, a tree or something like that. People say, yeah, you know, this bull came in and the only tree that he could have stood behind that would have saved his life, that bull stood behind. And it's like, it happens all the time. And I tell people, that's not an accident, especially when you notice that it happens all the time. Yeah. These bulls, we go out there for 2-3 months out of the year during hunting season, and we're playing the wind, and we're, you know, trying to figure out the bull, and we're looking at all the different signs, and we try to make it happen. And even if we do everything 100% right, that bull might do everything 100% right as well.
Yep.
And so that puts the odds of him being able to figure us out back in his corner. These elk live out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's all they know. And they live their lives trying to stay alive. That's their main focus, and that's what they focus on. And so they're looking for anything that's different. You know, they're checking the wind. They're looking for sign. They got a sixth sense about them that I think people lost a long time ago. And so we're up against a animal that is very equipped to stay alive out there. And so we have to be on our A game. And so when the client comes in, someone like Justin, and he's able to use his hunting skills and his natural instincts to be able to put himself into a position where he can take that shot and make the shot, that's when it all comes together. Yeah.
Yeah. I always think of it as whenever you finally learn an area well enough that the animals, you think you have the upper hand. Now the animals know you well enough because you hunt that area the same way that it doesn't work.
Right.
You got to keep jostling it up. They're super clever. It'd be like changing something in your living room and walking in there. I mean, they're in there constantly. And they live so long. That's what's impressive. They get to learn.
Especially the cows.
Oh, dude. There's some so cows. Smart. They know. I did a couple hunts for years and years and years, and I swear these cows know it. They're like, they know. It's like putting on a deer drive. They're like, can hear you coming. They're like, that's a dude, I'm pretty sure. Because a couple of the old ones, they blitz up out. There's no more, like years ago, they would like hang out and you'd be able to call them a little bit. But if you come in a certain way, they know you're a person almost instantly right then.
Yeah.
Because elk don't come from there. And
right.
How many people do you hear bugling from dumb locations like that during a year?
All the time.
And then we wonder why the elk are call shy.
Yeah. Yep.
And then we strategically kill off all the bugling bulls.
Yeah. Yeah. And we only leave the smart silent ones. But yeah, it even the second week with my other two clients that we had just a great week. We were within bow range of really big bulls several times, and when you're talking about, you know, your approach bugling from dumb areas, even there's so much to not only bugling properly or knowing the type of bugle at the right time, but also when's it time not to bugle.
Yes, exactly.
And these elk are so smart that they know what, like you said, by the time you know an area, those elk know you. They know my bugle, they know my cow calls, they know my pattern. And so you have to be able to think, well, I'm coming in quiet today. I'm coming in quiet, or I'm going to let this bull feed and I'm going to slip into his bedding area and I'm just going to sit there. And that's probably when we got, well, one of two times we got in close bugling. We had a huge bugling fight with this bull where I finally got tired of bugling. It's like, you know, this bull needs to make up his mind, but we had several bulls coming in, two at the same time at one time, right at the same time. Another one come walking up, standing right in between my two clients and but it didn't have a brow tine.
Oh.
But the big bull was just right down, I believe it was below Justin. It was the second week. Another Justin. And he was really, really, and both my clients that week were super. They would hike anywhere. They would do anything. They were very, very good at what they were doing. And I was really excited about getting a bull of that caliber to stand in front of one of them, because the next day, I think we were on him 2 days, but we just couldn't close the deal. And so he was down below us and he was making sounds that he was out of his mind screaming down below us. And so we tried to slip in, and all of a sudden we were right ready to drop down onto the flat with him. I really believe we would have had that bull this time, except I see some legs down in the brush moving as I'm walking in. We were walking right into the cows, and those cows ended up getting in between us and the bull and ended up winding us, and so they took off. The next day we come in, and we decided that we're going to slip up into his bed. And so we waited. Sure enough, that bull, like clockwork, started working down the ridge, taking his cows down below and to go feed and whatever they were doing down there. And we go all the way up, all the way back down around, making sure we're trying to be quiet. And I think that bull must have heard us, because he come back early. And next thing you know, we're about ready to drop down and get set up, and that bull screams. We're like, oh no. And so we get set up as quick as we could. And that bull ended up coming in and just didn't get the shot. He finally kind of fell. I think it's that sixth sense. It's like something's not right.
Yeah.
And so he just kind of walked on out of there. But it was great. It was a super good year.
Yeah. I love playing them big bull games.
Yeah.
They you can sit and run strategies and think when you're back at the lodge and you're laying in bed and you're like, I got it today.
Yeah.
He's going to get it.
Yeah. I know what he's doing.
And then they sucker you into making dumb mistakes during the hunt. And then you even know it, and you're like, oh, he's trying to pull us down there. I know what he's trying to do. And at some point in time of the day, he'll probably sucker you down there or sucker you into some position where he can figure a thermal out. Have you noticed, like, in these, like, really good bedding areas, you'll have a tight ravine, there'll be a rock slide, something that creates a thermal different in that little area. You can have steady thermals the whole way around the canyon, and then right there where the elk are at, it's like Alcatraz for us getting in. But
yeah, super common.
Yeah, I love that.
Yep.
You can almost just look on the ground topographically and find those little areas, and then trying to get into them.
Trying to figure out your thermals, when they're going to change. That's where the groundwork before hunting season, super important, is knowing that particular ridge, where they're bedding, why they're bedding there. You know, is it because it's an open where they can see predators coming up, you know, at them, or is it because of the thermals? And sometimes it's all of the above.
Yep.
And you get in there, and these bulls are hard to kill, but it's where they're at. We try to invite them into our game. Very seldom do they like to play our game, but they invite us into their game, and they're calling us to, you know, come, no, you come over here and show yourself, because I got eight cows sitting here, and I'm not going to play your game. I don't have to play your game.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You kill a high percentage of the bulls that you can pull up out of their little bedroom, their little home, where they feel comfortable. If you can get them up on a ridge, you'll kill a large percentage of them bulls, but if you get suckered into a bowl.
Yeah. They just abuse you.
Yep. It's fun, though. It's almost, some places I find that I can hunt very softly and not really get into the bedrooms and kind of bump around it and soft touch them. But some areas are so far of a hike and you're only going to touch them a couple times of the year that I just dive right into them, like, go until I get elk up. It sounds crazy, but sometimes if you come into them like a bull, that's what a bull is doing. A satellite bull is going to run down in and come right bomb a herd and get in there and try to find him a cow. So I don't get too nervous sometimes on those far out spots that I'm only going to hunt once or twice. They don't get maybe so skittish of us hunting it a certain way.
Yeah.
Like, Devin's been on a few of them hunts where we just super aggressive.
Yeah.
They work out a lot of times for good action, but you don't usually kill them. I don't know why. I think it's because it happens so fast that you need to have a client like Justin that's been on multiple. He's seen a lot of action, had a lot of mistakes. Yeah, what's going to work, what you can get away with. And then when you have to make a decision on the fly, like a running and gunning, they make those decisions way better.
Yeah.
Yeah, that group has been out with us 8 different times at least. It makes a difference.
So, Devin, you ain't said much on this podcast. No, taking it in.
Haven't been here in a year. I got hurt last year, so I didn't. I finally got to come out this year, got married.
That's why I was teeing you up for the marriage.
Got married, then got hitched. Got to get to come out this year. Get to guide this fall. Did some archery hunting last week. Me and Josh went out. Slowed up a little bit, didn't get into much. Seen some mule deer. It was fun.
It poured down rain 2 days and then snowed on us. And we hunted in bluebird days with people.
Soaking wet.
With client. You have these great experiences and then you get to go hunting for yourself. And it seems like I used them all up.
Yeah, we didn't hear nothing. Didn't hear no bulls. So Josh was upset that it was over.
I was. It's saddening when they're like archery season's over. I love the warm weather. I think that's the most.
Mm-hmm.
I'm skinny, so I don't like cold.
Can't stay warm.
Yeah. So you drew some wicked good tags the last few years. What do you have? A goat left, right?
Yeah, just a goat.
Just a goat.
Just a goat. Just an old goat.
He props his collar up there.
Yeah. I tell you, it's good, clean living. That's the key.
So we could do like a gym trilogy on all these special tags you drew. But the one that we got to all go on was the moose. It's been a few years ago, but you can tell your...
Yeah, it's been 4 years already.
So they only draw 2 moose tags every other year. So it's like a very covenant tag to draw here. How long did it take you to...
A little over 20 years.
20 years to draw the moose tag.
Mm-hmm.
How many days did you hunt?
I think I figured, just spitballing out there, I'm pretty close, but 40.
You always take them down to the very last.
Oh, yeah. Because I knew when I pulled the trigger, I'm not a moose hunter anymore.
Yeah.
It's done. So I've waited, 20 years of applying, and it's like I did not want to run out and shoot the first nice bull that I saw. And so my standards were almost, I purposely set them at impossible.
Yeah.
Because to me, the hunt's more than just the end result. That's, we usually like the horns to reflect the effort, and usually we think the size of the horn is representative of the effort that we gave. And sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. So
that's a good way to put it. I've never thought about it that way usually.
Yeah, a lot of people don't, but it's, and I tell people this because I think it's important for them to understand so that they can enjoy the hunt and enjoy the journey in between. And if all you're after is a big set of horns, I don't recommend a guided hunt. I would recommend going to eBay and buying someone else's effort and putting it on your wall. I mean, if that's what you're into, it's like, then your friends can come over and you can say, wow, that is a really nice bull. Yeah. Tell me the story. Well, I got on my computer and I went on eBay and I looked really, really hard. And days I put into this. And then finally I found the right set of horns and I purchased them. And they're like, wow, that's cool, man. And some people, if that's what you're into, more power to you. And then I think you can say, well, tell me about those horns. Well, it was a caged hunt. I go on this ranch and they're fenced in, and I went through the catalog and I looked and I picked this particular buck and it's really nice, or this bull, and we went out and shot it. Well, that, there's your story behind that set of horns. And then, it's probably, a 240, 250 whitetail. And it's just crazy big,
unrealistic.
Yeah, it's just out of the norm. And then you have somebody that has a rig horn bull, and you're like, oh, that's a smaller set of horns. Tell me the story. Well, I put in 40 days. I slept out in the forest and I hunted this thing and I got to know. And I mean, let me tell you about the blisters and the pain and the suffering. And I worked so hard for that animal. And let me tell you how I got him, and the strategy and how the first, second, third time it didn't work. But finally, we figured this thing out. And everybody's just you got them wrapped up in this story, and they're like, wow, you know, that is an experience. That's what that set of horns represent that hang on the wall. And so, I mean, I can go to the thrift store and get a trophy. You know, maybe it's a bowling trophy or a football trophy, and someone else earned it. And I can buy it for 50 cents, and I can bring it home and put it on my shelf and show everybody my trophy. It's like, wow, you played, you know, professional hockey? No, I bought that at the thrift store. You know, oh, okay. You know, people look at you, just kind of, that's weird, you know. Yeah. But if you, and that's what I love about this place. This place offers the unique opportunity for you to earn what you have hanging on your wall. And if you bring something home, it's because you earned it. There's a story behind it. And too many people today want a participation award rather than to go out and earn it. And so, I mean, if everybody's different, some people just want the trophy on the wall. They don't care about the story or the journey. But with that moose hunt, for me, it's like, at the end of the year, I had spent all the way through their rut. I learned to call moose in. I learned their habitat. I filmed them. I knew exactly where they were. We started naming them. You know, we named these moose because I knew where they were living. I knew their personalities. And I could identify them when I seen them. And so I put in the effort and the time. And by the time it was done, we were probably in 2 feet of snow. Bluebird day, beautiful. And there's this bull that we call Dibs, and there's old Dibs, he's down there feeding. And I had a few friends that wanted to go with me, and they're like, oh, you know, you only have a week left. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, that's a nice bull. I said, yeah, he is, that's old Dibs. And he said, well, boy, I don't know, I'm not telling you what to do, but I think I might shoot him. And I said, yeah, you know, well. And then the bull, he kind of dropped down a little further. I said, that was my excuse. Well, that old bull, he just dropped down a little too far. We should have shot him when he is further up. Maybe if that bull turns around and comes back, then we'll consider it. Well, sure enough, that bull turns around, comes back. I'm like, oh, man, Dibs. And they said, listen, we'll help you pack this thing out. And don't you want some meat out of this deal? And I'm like, yeah, you're right. And so set up on him. Made a shot, and even to this day, I feel bad for shooting Dibs. I was like, he's my buddy. I knew him. You know, I shot old Dibs. But we just, it was a tremendous hunt. Just, and so the horns that I have on my wall, I have many stories to tell. And they represent something more than just moose horns hanging on my wall. You know, yeah, honestly, I would rather let Dibs live and go buy one on eBay, you know, as far as like killing the animal. Killing the animal is not the most important thing to me. It's the journey. And then killing the animal gives me that fresh meat. It helps regulate the herd populations. And there's many reasons why it's a good thing. But killing is probably one of my least favorite parts of it, even though it's what I'm there to do.
Yeah, you can't really be a hunter without taking an animal's life, but
right.
I mean, that's the whole point that you're going after. But yep. The chase, that is the part that has been lost.
Well, yeah, social media and everything makes it to where that's how they evaluate how good of a hunter you are, is how big of an animal you post a picture with.
Right.
What you have on Instagram and Facebook.
Well, on Monday morning when they're gathered around their coworkers at the coffee, they're like, hey, did you get a bull? No, we didn't get a bull. That's the first thing that's going to be asked. Everybody, so it's like a trend. Everybody has the same mindset. Not, hey, how was your hunt?
Yeah.
Right.
Guaranteed the first question, did you kill one?
Kill anything.
Yeah. I'm guilty of it too. And I don't like killing stuff neither. In the back of my mind, I'm watching them through my binoculars. I'm like, now's your chance. Run.
Get away. Save yourself.
Seriously, I'm not. Yeah, because you do. You like, I would not want someone that, there's a bull that I've chased around for years, and I would be devastated if someone didn't put in the honest effort to go kill that bull. You know what I mean? And like, shot him from a truck, whatever, you know what I mean? It would be a dishonor to all the years that he's got away from, he's outsmarted everybody to get killed like that, I think.
Yep.
We did. We took you. We wasted one of your days moose hunting. Took you. We went rock climbing. Remember?
Oh, yeah. That was great.
That was fun.
That was fun. That's part of it.
Yeah. There was a bull living in there in archery season, and then we went rock climbing.
Hiking through
swamp.
Feet of snow. Yeah. I remember. You know, remember how long it took us to get in there and out?
Yeah.
But back up a few weeks, you called me up in archery and said, hey, we should go in there Sunday. I said, I got to preach on Sunday. Okay. You said, I think we can get in there and out before. Oh, yeah. I'm like, what? I'm like, there is no way.
Yeah, that was all day.
It was all day. I still have it on video of you guys stomping through that snow. And then when we had to wrap around, it was a cliff.
Yeah.
You know, and it was.
The trail went away.
I'm not really big. Yeah, the trail left us. And you said, well, we can go right through here. And I'm looking, and I don't like heights.
You don't like heights?
I don't know. And it's all ice. I'm like, this is the place that I die.
If we had to kill the moose, it would have been epic.
It would have been epic,
We'd had to eat on it that night.
Oh, yeah, we'd been camping there.
Oh, that would have been great. And I found in there that cave where you drop in straight down. Yep. It was like a hole.
That's right.
I'm walking along through these rocks, and I look straight down, and I bet you it's about a 10 or 12-foot drop. So I'm like, what in the world? I couldn't even see the bottom. So I got my headlamp out, and I looked down in there, and then I could see down in. And I could see it took off, and it almost looked like it was hand-carved. Like the walls were totally flat. The roof was totally flat. So I ended up dropping down in there, which I'm like, I wonder what kind of animal might think this is cool, too. You know, I drop down in there, and there's a bobcat or, you know, who knows what. Anyways, I did it. And I dropped down in there, and then it goes back for, I don't know, maybe 15 feet. And then it looks like the soil had trickled in, so it's blocked off. But I could look up in there, and I could see I could go further if I wanted to start belly crawling. But then I thought, I'm so far back in here. Nobody knows where I am, and I'm underground. And I'm thinking, if a rock shifts and pins me, this is it.
So was it an old mine, you think?
No, I don't know what it is.
Just a rock over time, just sheared off that.
Yeah, it was like totally, totally flat. A lot of people, when I show them the picture, they think it's carved, but I mean, I think I'd have been able to tell.
Indians.
That's what you think. It's like, well, I bet you an Indian had something better to do than this.
Yeah, be on a rock.
Yeah, he's down there chipping for days. But anyways, it's just part of the memory of, you know, my moose. When I look at it, you know, you guys going in with me and putting in all that effort and time, and there's other people that put in so much effort and time, and you wonder why somebody would do that. It's because the journey is most of the fun.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And we get to experience that together sometimes. That's why you don't have to ask people to go on your moose hunt. They're asking you if they can go. Can I go with you? It's like, yeah, I'd love for you to go.
How was the pack out for the moose?
It was great. Because, you know, so I started working it up, and Kyle Wangard was there, and Sheldon and
boys pack mule.
So those two loaded themselves up with moose, and the hard part was, it was, you know, everything's steep here, but there was so much snow, and so they took off, and we weren't done working up the moose. By the time we finished working up the moose, getting everything bagged and taking all our pictures, and we passed them coming down, so I ended up, and they were coming down to grab the rest of it. So they took two trips, and I only had to take one, and I shot the moose.
That's good.
It's like, right on.
You guys did some double dipping that day, didn't you? Didn't you get a bull that?
Oh, not on that day, but previously, probably 2 weeks prior to that, we were coming down this ridge, and I had been down that ridge 20 times that year, you know, scouting or hunting, and I looked over, and it was a long ways off, and I see this little dot in the middle of a natural open that was never there before, just teeny tiny little dot. And I told Sheldon, I said, hey, there's something there. So we get out our spot and scopes, and we look, and here's this really nice bull laying there. And he goes, I know we're moose hunting, but I would really like to shoot that bull. So I handed him my gun, and I said, yeah, let's do it. And so it was so steep coming down off that side of the hill, but it was so steep, but the snow was so deep that we actually had to push to get through it. It was like, people say usually, you know, the snow was up to my waist, and usually it's not. you know, they just feel like it is. This was up to our waist. It was so deep. And then we get down into the first bottom. It's one of those bottoms that you hit the bottom, and where you start climbing is only about 10 or 12 feet across. You're just in a ravine. And we get down in there, and it was so deep in that ravine, it was over our waist. And I'm looking up in both directions thinking, I don't know if we're going to get out of this thing. And we did. We swam up the other side, and we made our way all the way over to where we got within shooting range of this bull. And Sheldon was shooting my 340 Weatherby, and he made a great shot. And we got over there, and this bull, we didn't know, but had this really nice, heavy drop tine coming down off of it. Just an old bull. And we didn't get out of there, man, until morning. We were working it up, and Galen and Sheldon, once again, great guys. They came walking all the way in, and I'm glad they did, because we didn't know the way out. We were just like straight line. And if we would have went that straight line, we would have went through dead fallen brush. They found an old packer trail coming in. And so we packed it out, made it out in the morning, and got home. And I remember how exhausted, I was soaked and wet and cold, pine needles and sticks stuck to me everywhere. And it's, you're so exhausted and so worn out, but there's like no greater feeling in the world than that. It's like,
you can't hardly sleep, even though you're so tired. You're just sitting there, your adrenaline is still just, you're replaying everything.
Yeah. Wide awake.
Then the next day is just a normal day, and you're like, man, I've got to do it again.
What year was your ram? Was that 2 years?
Yeah, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yeah, moose tag, and then 2 years later, a ram tag. So I guess 2024 was supposed to be my goat tag, so they messed up. But I figured if I got a moose tag, a ram tag, and then my goat tag, that I would lose all my friends. So, people were like trying to be happy for me, but it's like, hey,
I would be. You're out of the pool then.
Yeah.
So how many years for your sheep till you can
five more?
Yeah. Is it different for goats and...
No,
7 years.
Now you can go to hunt the unlimited. There's areas that you can go, but the chances even finding a ram are slim to none.
And I really don't want to race other people.
No.
Like if I get a tag for one of these animals, they're so, so cool that I don't want to rush it. It's like, I don't even want to shoot them. It had better be the world record for me to shoot one of these special tags on the first day, because I want to put in the time. I mean, I want to know exactly what's out there. I want to know what it's like to hunt them.
Experience it all.
Yeah, I want to experience it all. What a waste to just focus on the getting something killed. I mean, that's cool and all. And some people, that's what, you know, more power to them. But for me, man, if I don't get to experience, it's like I robbed myself of something, of one of the more important parts of the hunt, and that's the journey.
Yeah, your ram hunt, you took it down to the very last couple days too, right? Mm-hmm. That I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah, I was about spent though. I was almost done. Because on a sheep hunt like that, you went back into some of the areas with me, and you know, then you get winter time and the deep snow, and it's everything's kind of accumulates. At first, you're healthy and happy, and then you get down to where you're skinny and tough, and then you get down to where you're too skinny and weak, and you're like, you don't know how much more you got left in you. But it's like, if at the end of my sheep hunt, if I had anything left in the tank, I'd have felt like I didn't do a good enough job. I wanted to be, and it actually took me a couple years to feel normal, like right again, health-wise. I ended up losing 40 pounds.
Oh, I know. You look like an ice sculpture.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I look like one of those Olympic ice skaters. You're not looking very good. It's like, no, I think I'm going to die. But man, can you think of a better way to die?
No.
I can't.
No. It's wicked cool we have a place that can test men and peel them apart like onions. Every person. I don't know anybody that can handle this place. It's just how long.
Yep.
Some guys can handle it more days in a row than others. And it just comes down to a state of mind. Physical, I mean, you got to be physically fit, but
mentally,
mm-hmm. just enjoying it. We had fun the whole entire time. Oh, yeah. Laughed and giggled. And
you know, if you go back in there, it's you don't want to go for just a day. So maybe probably the least amount of time would be 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And the most was about a week. After that, your food starts running out, and you still do have responsibilities back in the real world, whatever world we want to call it. But
after Mountain House for 10 days, you can almost fill your tent up with gas and just gravitate down off of the mountain.
Yeah. Yeah. After about a week, the grizzlies won't even pester you anymore.
So you doubled up on that hunt too, right? Because when you were sheep hunting, that's when you got that mule deer.
Mm-hmm.
Buck of a lifetime.
Yeah. Was that an easy decision while you were sheep hunting? Were you like,
Yeah. You know, we seen a nice buck when we were in there.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't have been one that I would have shot. He was, I don't know what size he was.
He was probably just a pretty 140, high 140 buck, I'd say. Yeah. Maybe a little better than that, but
he
didn't have the trash like the gnarly mountain buck yet. He was still pretty.
He's just laying up there being pretty. He'll be nice this year probably.
Yeah.
But no, I had no desire. I actually passed up the opportunity at a really, really big bull elk. But I was so focused on that ram. You ever play pool where the person you're playing against says, okay, no slop.
Yeah.
So you need to call your shot. If you make a different ball in, you still lose your turn because that's not what you were trying for. It's the same thing with me with hunting. I want to know, I'm not just staggering through the woods hoping that something, anything would step out in front of me. I want to know what I'm hunting. I want to know the caliber of animal I'm hunting. And then before I pull that trigger, I want to know exactly what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And so, I mean, there's you know, depending on how much time you have and what you want out of your hunt, sometimes you need to, for you to be satisfied with that hunt, you need to know the animal that you're going to pull the trigger on. And, but with, you know, with my sheep hunt, my moose hunt, even that, well, when that elk was standing out in front of me, it's like, I'm not interested. You know, I was so focused.
That would have been a terrible pack out for an elk.
Oh, yeah.
Like, honestly, that would have tested some people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a terrible pack for any, just to get yourself out.
Yeah. Couldn't imagine.
I mean, you're back there miles and miles, and you're in... You're not just walking on trails. You're scaling blowdowns, mountains.
Those tight canyons, those avalanches just shove everything down in them bottoms. And that's the only place that you can get around that time of year. So you're just crawling through that stuff.
Remember that avalanche we heard?
Yeah.
That was...
That was nuts. It went on for like 10 seconds, it seemed. I don't know.
Oh, a long time.
The whole mountain like
just gave rolling. Away. Yeah.
That's shaking the ground like earthquake type of stuff.
There was a lot of material that was coming down, and it was like, what in the world is that? And then we figured out what it was. I mean, it's an avalanche.
If you can't see God in nature when you're out here, it's like that avalanche going and things like that. That's just, you could be gone in a second. I mean, like, here, you're back there camping, having a good time. Here, I could just wipe you out instantly. And
no one would even know.
No.
I'd never find you.
And I think that's one of the great things about what we do is the people that are coming here, many of them are coming from places where they don't get to have that really close connection with God's creation. And God's word says that his creation itself declares that there's a God. And so when they come out here, it strips away a lot of the veneer of the world that we live in, where it's the 9 to 5, it's the going to the park where it's all mowed and manicured. And in some cities, the lights are so bright at night that many people don't get to see the stars and the beauty of it all. And they're just kind of trapped. I think I call it trapped in their own little world where they don't even realize what's outside of the walls. And I think sometimes we can create prisons for ourselves. And we think that we're affluent within the walls that we live, but we've made ourselves our own little prison walls. And when they come here, they realize, man, it's like, this is beautiful. It's like, I don't hear the cars. I don't see the street lights. I'm not surrounded by convenience. And I was just talking the other day about, you know, people that live in squalor. And these people, you ever watch that show, Hoarders?
Yep.
It just breaks my heart when I watch it. It's like these poor people are so tormented and they're just suffocated in this filth, you know, in the garbage that they've accumulated. And all they do is just stack it higher and more, and they think it's their treasure. But we do that with stuff, you know. We're just, it's nicer, newer stuff. We just stack more and more stuff, almost like a pack rat. And I need this, I need a new car, I need a boat, I need, you know, all these things that I have to have. And we surround ourselves with it, and we find out in the end that our things end up owning us. It's like, man, I got two or three vehicles, and I got oil changes and tires, and I got to go work, and I got to work overtime, and I got to worry about my insurance, and, you know, my kids have to do this and they have to do that, and I have to have all these, you know, different things going on in my life. And we essentially were hoarders, just like the people that we're looking at feeling sorry for on the TV. We just do it with new stuff. And when you can step out of that and you can see the world from, I would say, God's perspective, that, you know, your relationship with Him and His creation is far more important than your relationship with this world and the things that you can acquire in it. And it's a very seductive trap that too many people have fallen into. And you hear clients say, you know, I would love to live out here and do what you do, but I've got too much going on at home, you know. And so they're chained to a life that they've almost like a trap stepped into. And they got to realize that you only get one life. And so you better spend it wisely, because you don't get to say, you know, oh, well, I made a few mistakes. Next time I'm going to do better. Well, you don't get a next time. So you better get it figured out now. And a guided hunt like this that they come in on, man, I've had so many great conversations with people about God. And that's what they want to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, you know, I'm out there, hey, can I talk to you about God? It's like, they're like, hey, so... I heard you're a pastor, you know, tell me about that, you know. And then it just goes from there. And then pretty soon we're having conversations about things that are far more important than the price of the truck that they just bought, or the size of the house they live in, or, you know, it's a different world they're stepping into. So you're getting so much more by coming out here. And this is a unique section of the country that you can step into and out of a lot of the stuff that you end up getting caught in.
Yeah, I think that some people think that when they're feeling God in nature, and that they describe it differently. They're like, oh, I got this such a primal, primitive feeling when I was out there. And dude, that's nature and God you were feeling. It is that someone needs to describe it to you that way. And that's why I love being out in the woods with you. It's like you always describe it in a way that's very understanding, and you grasp it like morally. Very eye-opening. Guys are lucky that they get to go hunting with you. I know that we as guides, we appreciate you being here, because everybody toes the line. I mean, they don't want you coming down. It's just good, because guiding has a lot of young men in it. I mean, and those clients, they watch us, they follow us. I mean, they're following a headlamp through the woods in front of them. You know what I mean? They're trusting us, and then the guide has to put his trust in someone that he's just wandering through the blind woods. And that's sometimes what we need to be able to describe, how we have that, just go into the unknown. You know what I mean? And that's, I always feel that nothing's going to happen to us, because you already know God has, like, it set aside, like, what's going to happen to you. So when you're in there and that avalanches and all that, and grizzly bears could eat us, dude, let's just sit here for the adventure, because it's stories wrote and like already.
Right.
No point in sitting there worrying about it.
Nope.
You know, it may never happen.
Yeah. Very grateful you work for us, Jim.
Well, I appreciate that.
Honestly. I know you're a busy man, and you're with preaching, you do a lot of talking, so having you come talk on these, but it's a great tool for people to listen and like get to know us and what we're trying to show.
Right.
We're after that chase. We're, you're not going to kill a lot of these animals, and it's cool to have a worthy adversary to go after. Tip our hat to the elk in the mountains and be thankful that there's, we live in America, that we can go do that.
Yeah, it's not always all about killing.
No. Yeah.
This is us over and out.